Just talking with Austin about the poem that I read at the beginning. So I called it a prayer for peace. I imagine some of you may have heard versions of it before, but as I was, it has come to mind several times lately. Often when I find the news challenging, I like to start with the Metta Sutta, both in my own practice and when I'm teaching. And this prayer for peace has come to mind often lately as I said, a similar sentiment, but in slightly different words in a different tradition. So I thought of bringing that up tonight. But as I was researching it to make sure that of the title and who wrote it, it's often attributed to St. Francis, but as these things go, he likely wasn't the one who wrote it. So scholars have said it probably wasn't him, and I loved this, said it probably wasn't him because there's too much I and me in the poem, right? Which sounds very Buddhist. This is just from Wikipedia, but not, my research wasn't too deep, but said, oh, this poem couldn't have come from St. Francis because there's too much self-referentiality in it. So who knows? But it does seem to be true that many different traditions have the same kind of maybe emphasis on kindness and a way of being in the world that doesn't contribute to the problem, right? Maybe just doesn't reinforce the patterns of, talk about this some more in the talk, but greed, hatred, and delusion that are rolling on, yeah? That perhaps invites us into an intention to bring something different to the conversation. So I think this is at the heart of many traditions and certainly the Buddhist one as well. So as many people know, probably not everyone, this year we're exploring the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which is the heart of our practice, the heart of the path, Buddha's core central teaching, in which he describes four things that are not to be believed, but they're to be practiced with. And in the process of practicing with them creatively, they become ennobling, right? So perhaps they allow us to bring something different rather than a rehashing, a replaying, a retracing of patterns of suffering. So in the Four Truths, in brief, there is suffering. Not all life is suffering, but there is suffering. There is an origin of that suffering or a cause, which is craving. There is an end, and there is a way or a path to that end. So many of these things are simple to talk about, but quite difficult to practice. And what we're focusing on this year, which I think is quite interesting and allows a real depth to come forward, is that we're focusing on the insights of these truths. So each of the four truths has a process by which that truth or that understanding might become integrated, might become one's own, might become embodied rather than thought about. Right? So in the process of understanding dukkha, with each of these four, there's a way of approaching it. So the three insights for dukkha, or suffering, It's the word, the Pali word for suffering, stress, dukkha. There is dukkha. Dukkha is to be understood. So there's something to be done about it. There's a direction, a way to approach it. And then dukkha has been understood. So there's a sense of having come to a different kind of relationship with this fact of suffering, with this experience of suffering. When we come to the second noble truth, which is what we've been, or ennobling truth, which is what we've been working with this month, February, we explore craving as the origin of suffering in a human life. Right? So this truth says that craving, which I'll talk about as we go, is to be abandoned. So again, there's something that we can do with it, a way of relating to it. So craving is to be let go of, is to be abandoned. And then the final insight is craving has been let go of. Craving has been abandoned. Yeah. So all of these things can be known. We can bring awareness to them at different levels. And there's a sense of a deepening, again, a deepening process, but a way of integrating this that moves from intellectual understanding to embodiment. So we might start with that first piece. How does craving relate to suffering? So we can take it as a question. How do I, when I let go of craving, or when craving kind of lets go of me, what is the outcome of that? How does that affect suffering? What is the relationship there? Again, craving, we could say rather than should, craving can be abandoned, and then we can know that craving has been abandoned. So these insights are a slightly different way of approaching the four ennobling truths. And insight, again, is part of the tradition that we're practicing in. We move from an intellectual understanding to a direct, kind of intuitive knowing. Right? So it's worth just kind of pausing there for a moment, right? Because again, these things are easy to get intellectually. But we're really aiming for a different aspect of the mind, engaging a different aspect of the mind and understanding. And that is what has kind of liberating potential. It's not just accumulating better ideas and philosophies. So this is a very common theme in this particular practice tradition. So this is from Ajahn Jayasaro, a British monk in the Thai forest tradition, who wrote these beautiful kind of practice pointers by hand, and I think was often posting them on social media during the pandemic. But anyway, this is a beautiful book, From Heart and Hand. And he writes, "The most profound matters are not so difficult to understand intellectually. What could be simpler to explain than impermanence? The challenge is to train the mind to the level that the intellectual understanding may act as a springboard to a direct, life-changing insight beyond the reach of words." The challenge is to train the mind to the level that the intellectual understanding may act as a springboard to a direct, life-changing insight beyond the reach of words. So that's when we know something at the level of our bones, the level of our reflexes, right? And we know that we know. We may not know it for all time and forever, but we know it. Craving is the cause of suffering. I see that. I've seen that play out in my own mind. I can see that it should be abandoned. I can see when it has let go, it feels like this. Yeah. So this is the movement. This is the trajectory. This is a non-linear process, in case you haven't noticed. But I love Ajahn Jayasaro's words that it moves eventually beyond the reach of words. And we can't strategize our way towards this direct intuitive understanding. We can't really orchestrate it in the usual way that we orchestrate or plan or strategize. It comes about through our attending in a certain kind of way, pulling out of the grip of thought, and relating, learning to relate to our experience differently than the usual habitual way. So this formulation is very powerful, right? Both the four and the deepening into the insights. So dukkha is to be understood. Craving is to be let go of. The ending or cessation is to be realized. And the path is to be cultivated. Yeah. So this can sound like a lot of work. It can sound like a lot of doing. It's like, oh, maybe I can't. Isn't this just a time to relax and calm down? This is a lot of doing. What we find as we practice is that I'm suddenly flashing on a lyric of an Ani DeFranco song, which is, it takes some doing to see this undoing through, right? It takes some doing to see this undoing through, which means it takes a little bit of experimenting, of being willing, of exploring, of working, to uncondition some of these habit patterns of our mind. This is a process of unconditioning. Stephen Batchelor, at one point, the scholar, often calls himself a secular Buddhist, and so his formulation of the Four Noble Truths in terms of how we approach them, he shortens it to embrace, let go, stop, act. So he calls that ELSA, because we love acronyms, right? And he talks about that as a new operating system for our being. Yeah. Suffering is to be embraced. Craving is to be let go of. Stopping is to be known. And act. So often we want to go right for the acting. What should I do? What should I do? What's next? How should I do? What should I do next? But this is a way of working with our mind's deepest tendencies, which I'll talk about in a minute, that leads to a radically different way of relating and responding. Okay. So this second noble truth, ennobling truth, or the let go piece, is kind of the whole thing. So So this process of letting go, we first have to understand that craving is not a decision. Right? We don't decide to crave. Right? So the Buddhist, the Pali word for craving is called tanha. It's translated as tanha, and it's translated as thirst. Right? Thirst. So it points to a deep instinctual drive that we have, just like being thirsty for water. And it points to a way of relating to the pleasant and unpleasant in our lives, in our experience. So just in the same way that when we're thirsty, we crave water, in the same deep instinctual way, when we encounter experiences, relationships, sensations that are unpleasant, we instinctively pull away or push away or try to get rid of. That is a form of craving. Craving isn't just pulling things towards us that we want. It's the push-pull, the wanting, the not wanting. And it arises in particular in response to pleasant and unpleasant experiences. Right? So we can feel this push-pull. And so the kind of proposition here is that it is not so much the unpleasant in our lives or the pleasant in our lives that is suffering, but it's our relationship to it, right? It's the pushing and the pulling and the not relating wisely that gets us into deeper and deeper forms of suffering. So if we think about it as a reflex, just I've been describing it a lot lately, as like an impersonal reflex. So when we hit our knee, like right below the knee, somebody hits the knee, and your foot comes out, and it's an instinctual reflex, right? So in much the same way that thirst is a reflex. So I know I've spent a lot of time working with elders and doing end-of-life care, and at the end, for several people I've been with towards the end of their lives, when even though they feel like ready to die, yeah, they've lived a good life, it's no longer feels, for a variety of reasons, they feel like they're ready to let go. It's not so easy to just make a decision to let go. So one client who I was taking care of would often decide, okay, I'm not going to eat or drink anymore, right? I'm ready. I'm at peace. I've lived a good life. I'm 99, whatever, I'm ready. And then in the evening at about 9 o'clock, she would say, oh, but that pudding in the refrigerator. Oh, that pudding, that chocolate pudding, it's in the refrigerator. It's so good. So maybe just a little bit of the pudding. Yeah. So these deep instinctual, drives just to continue. Yeah. Have more of the pleasant or to push away the unpleasant. They're with us. They're with us in a very deep way. So how I'd like to approach this tonight is from a couple different angles. So first, to really feel the push-pull of craving, that it's not just a pulling of things towards us, it's also a pushing away. And I'd like to talk about the three kinds of craving, but also to talk about the similes that the Buddha used for abandoning craving. So the Buddha often used similes to describe what he was talking about, rather than long kind of intellectual treatises, philosophies or descriptions. And I love this about the teachings because it may be very difficult to translate certain words and understand exactly what was meant, the nuances, but a tree now is likely, has a lot of the same similarities to a tree, to trees at the time of the Buddha, or dust, or fire, or fruit. You know, many of the similes, often natural and organic, are similar to things that we see now and we can experience now. So there's a kind of timeless quality to the similes, uncomplicated, and also we can feel them. Yeah, we can feel them directly. We don't have to think about them. We know what it's like to be thirsty, to need, to experience drinking water after having been thirsty for a long time. Case in point. But first to talk, and I imagine Tim and Suze and I think Steve have spoken to some of this month, but I know not everyone has been here this month, to speak about the three kinds of craving just briefly, or thirsting. And the first one is just a craving for sense experience, right? I like to just think of this is a craving for, just craving for more experience, more pleasant experience, right? Like, and there can be a kind of consumerish way that we want to like feed on more experience. So very simple examples. I just spent a short bit of time in Northern California with my extended family, visiting family. The first time in a long time, like 15 years, that I have been to the Bay Area in a non-Dharma, explicitly non-Dharma time. And so we spent one day with kids and relatives in San Francisco after visiting family for a long time, or for several days. And in this particular trip, the kids are at a point where we're, for better or worse, we're letting them help plan what we do, right? So our one day in San Francisco, we ended up going to the Candy Emporium, and to Alcatraz, right? So this is what happens when you let the kids plan your adventures. So but the Candy Emporium is a place where every single sense door is stimulated at the same time, right? You've got loud music, you have bright lights, you have every single color of artificial candy all at once. You have very cheerful people trying to talk to you about candy. It's everything all at once. And watching people, sitting on a bench, just watching people come in and out of the Candy Emporium, and, you know, kids included, it's like you're losing all body awareness completely, and we're just going from stall to stall, filling up these bags just more and more and more. And this is a hopefully kind of innocent example of this craving for more kind of sense experience, right? And it is not, important part is that it is not bad or evil or wrong, right? But it sets up a certain relationship to experience that is not a helpful place to dwell permanently, right? Because we lose awareness of the bigger picture. That's all. We lose awareness of our maybe deeper intentions. We lose awareness of other people. We're not so focused on things like kindness, generosity, and compassion. We're interested on feeding on the next experience, right? Rarely is someone deeply satisfied by one Sour Patch, blue Sour Patch bear, you know? They have to get the next one or the more interesting one. So again, this is kind of a stand-in for the way in which we kind of feed on more experience. We do this not just with pleasant tastes, but we do this with relationships. We do this with many aspects of our experience. This kind of feeding on a different variety of pleasant experience, right? This craving for more, better, more and better pleasant experiences. The second form of craving is a craving, it's the craving to become. And this is a bit more insidious, but this is where the sense of I or a sense of identity starts to form around the act or the craving movement. Right? There starts to become a very solid sense of me, the one who is experiencing, is wanting this experience or not wanting that experience. So it sets up, again, a relationship to what's around us that is kind of independent, isolating, self-referential, self-focused. There's a sense of wanting to become something more in the future, wanting to become the one who is having that experience. And this aspect of craving always sets up an othering, right? So this is an important part. Every time there's a selfing in this craving to become, there's always an othering, right? It's always me over here and you or something else over there, right? So it skews our relationships, our way of relating. We lose our sense of wholeness. So the craving to become is also a craving to continue existing, right? So existing means to stand out. So it's the craving to have an identity that is special, that is different, that is better, that stands out. So in this, we see very strong, or we can feel very strong relational pulls to be approved of, to be liked, to be wanted, to be understood, to be the one who stands out. So again, these are reflexes, and we can experience them as a kind of longing or a pull for, it comes down to a certain kind of safety. If I stand out and am seen and am related to in a certain way, then I will be safe. Yeah, I'll have a kind of solid position. So this is a craving to become a more improved version of myself in the future. Right? We can feel this as a pull. What's a bit harder to understand is the craving to not become, the craving for non-becoming. And this I experience as a pulling away from experience. from relationship, from being, from existing in this particular kind of way. So relationally, we can experience this as the desire to not exist like this, like in this. So this is a desire to withdraw, to hide, to not be seen, to be invisible, to be kind of under the radar. So I talked about this at Under 40 last time, and Gregory Kramer is a wonderful contemplation around this form of kind of relational craving to both exist, to stand out, or to withdraw, to be kind of under the radar. When I first heard this description of this craving to not be in this way, it was so relieving to have someone describe this, right? So this, in the Pali language, this is vibhava tanha. I think it's easier for us to kind of understand the sort of self-improvement, like imagining fantasies of ourselves or just becoming something a little bit better in the future. But this not wanting to exist or stand out can be a little bit harder to get a sense of. But when we can feel it as an urge to withdraw, to not be seen, to stay kind of safe and hidden, then I think we can understand it a little bit better as kind of the flip side of that other reflex or impulse. You know, if anyone has ever had a desire to kind of not feel, right? You've ever taken a substance or longed for sleep or wanted or preferred a kind of dullness, you know, perhaps with TV or anything else, a kind of dulling of experience, like not wanting to kind of exist so much in this. It doesn't feel so great all the time. We can really, and for many of us who've had experiences that have been threatening, perhaps because of various identities that we might have or how we're perceived, it can be very threatening to stand out in certain ways, right? So it can be safer to pull back, to hide, to withdraw in various ways. So anyway, that's been an extremely helpful teaching for me. So hopefully just the knowing of that is can be helpful. To name it as powerful. Again, not as evil, not as something wrong, but as preventing a wise whole view. When we're in the grip of craving of any kind, there's a narrowing of focus. Right? You can always feel a kind of narrowing of focus. Whether it's a push or a pull, the view gets narrower. And the becoming is simply a reaction to, not simply, but is a strong reaction to a mind's, to the projection of our mind. Yeah. So we can sense this happening. We can feel this happening. Okay. So a couple similes just to, have something hopefully to take with you and around the abandoning of craving. And then I'd love to hear from you what your sense of this might be. So one simile the Buddha pointed to in terms of craving and abandoning craving is that of a thorn being embedded, and the abandoning of craving as being like removing or extracting a thorn that was stuck in the heart. So this is the sutta. I'm sure many of you have heard this. This is the discourse. This is called the Atadanda Sutta, and I'll just read part of it. And I think this is an extremely helpful teaching for the time that we're in as well, in which there's a lot of reactivity, a lot of fear, a lot of misunderstanding happening collectively. So these are the words from the Buddha. Fear is born from arming oneself. Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. I love this image. I mean, it's a painful one, but creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. This world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. But then I discerned here a thorn, hard to see, lodged deep in the heart. Then I discerned here a thorn, hard to see, lodged deep in the heart. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if that thorn is taken out, one does not run. One settles down. Who here has crossed over craving? The world's bond, so hard to get past. He does not grieve, she does not mourn. His stream is cut, she is unbound. What went before, let go of that. All that's to come, have none of it. Don't hold on to what's in between, and you'll wander fully at peace. For whom there is no eye making all throughout the body and mind, and who grieves not for what is not, is undefeated in the world. For whom there is no this is mine, nor anything like that is theirs, not even finding selfness, she does not grieve at I have nothing. So there's a lot in there. That could be a whole life's contemplation in there. But the bit about the thorn refers to craving and clinging. All right. So craving is that move towards possessing. Clinging is the movement, once we have it, to hold on to it as ours, possessiveness. It's the push away of what we don't want. And once we've pushed it away, to continue to defend, yeah, keep out, keep back. We can feel these as movements that, like thorns, aren't intrinsic to the heart itself. Yeah. The tendencies are there, but like a thorn, this craving can be removed, it can be let go of. Our experience is different as we learn how to let go of that thorn, extract that thorn. So the second, and maybe I'll just say, as we're on that topic, that the primary way that we have for relating wisely with experience as it's happening is a kind of clear, direct, hopefully more and more sustained awareness to the flow of experience as it's happening moment by moment, without elaboration, proliferation, story making, a lot of which is I making, me making, my making, possessing, right? That urge to possess. So when we see things in their kind of bare essentials, we can see, just like in the meditation tonight, we can feel, there's heat here. There's pain here. There's trembling here. There's fear here. Without it proliferating, without it leading to a chain reaction of reflex and grasping. Right? So that is our primary tool, and that is our practice over and over again. And that leads naturally in the direction of abandoning. We don't have to do, and in fact, we can't do a major extraction effort, right? It can be a slow and gradual removal. Yeah. So the second simile perhaps is more helpful in that regard, and that's of a snake shedding its skin. It's a powerful image in the suttas. And this is the process that we go through as we're letting go of what binds us and afflicts us, in the kind of natural way that a snake lets go of its skin. It lets go of what is no longer needed and necessary for this task at hand. These instincts are helpful at a certain level, to a certain degree. They're helpful in order to kind of ensure our physical survival as a species. However, there's a point at which they're operating and they are counterproductive. Right? We can feel that now, experience that now. So this process by which the snake sheds its skin, we kind of outgrow the need or the reliance on some of these objects of craving. We no longer need them in the same way. Yeah, the jelly beans in the candy emporium no longer hold me in the same enthralling glow as they did when I was 10. Yeah. So we kind of outgrow some of these cravings. But for many of us, for most of us, for most of the time, we're like a snake that has half shed the skin. Yeah. We're in process. We're not all the way done. And this can get, the Buddha said, this process can lead to disgust and exasperation. Yeah? Halfway in the middle of molting. Yeah? And so this is the position many of us find ourselves in most of the time. We can feel how what we're doing is no longer helpful, but we're not completely free of it yet. Yeah, isn't this the process? And so to not get frustrated or irritated or despondent about this, but to keep bringing our compassionate understanding to the task at hand, to what we're doing, what we're exploring. And the Buddha says that in this messy middle, of the shedding of the skin, it's actually helpful to feel this exasperation and kind of disgust. Yeah. Oh, this no longer fits. This is no longer the whole. This does not define me. This is not all of who I am. It is also extremely helpful to feel the support of friends, Sangha, around you during those times. So, this is also the Buddha somehow described that this is like a snake using a bit of a stick to get the last skin shed. So we need the skillful reflection of people around us, reminding us of our deepest intention, reminding us of what's possible, also reminding us that perhaps the projections that other people have put on us that have not been healthy or wholesome or hopeful are not the only ways of relating, right? We can also start to feel at this stage that the release or the shedding or the putting down is far more pleasurable than the getting. And this is a really important phase of practice. We start to get a feel for it. The getting caught up and the letting go. The feeling the urge or the pull towards something and not following it. Feeling the urge to pull back, pull away, disengage, not show up, and taking the next step forward anyway, right? So we start to get a feel for that, and it feels like a kind of release and relief and letting go. So the insights around this are knowing that we know, right? That last insight that I was pointing to is knowing that we know. So all along the way, we can kind of prioritize or celebrate the knowing rather than what is being known. What is being known can be very painful. It can have a strong pull or a push. But if we're prioritizing the knowing, we can celebrate that, delight in that. That we do have this capacity to relate differently, to respond differently, and to know that we know. All right, so I think I'll close there. But we can start to hopefully approach our experience with this. Think of these truths as kind of invitations into a different way of relating to our experience. Again, a process of unconditioning. So whether you think of it as removing a thorn or shedding a skin, or the last one was cooling a process of inflammation, which we can do internally, which we can do collectively, this is the direction that the teachings point to. Yeah. So we all have a part to play in, I think of in cooling the flames of our world right now, but also in creating cultures that are organized around different principles. So this is what we do when we gather in Sangha. We don't need to be gathering together, organized around greed, hatred, and delusion, right? We get to create something different together. We can organize around principles of generosity, of kindness, and of the possibility of deep letting go that leads to freedom. So it may feel insignificant or unrelated to spend a couple of hours kind of squirming in discomfort and not immersing oneself in pleasant sensations, but this is how we uncondition our minds. Yeah? We give our minds different things to feed on, and we work with the pleasant and the unpleasant as it arises moment to moment. Okay, lots of talking. Let's sit Let's sit quietly for a moment. And can remember where we began, which is words that lead to a direct understanding beneath the words. It's always the invitation to which the practice points. So I'd love to hear if there are questions or comments, your own reflections before we close tonight. Anne and then Austin.
Carrie, I appreciated that. Very loud.
Okay.
Yes, that's better. So can you, so thought-provoking, this truly, I can spend weeks on it, but can you talk a little bit more about the craving to become versus kind of like healthy self-development?
Yeah.
Is there, 'cause it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this is something that we can explore for ourselves and kind of get a feel for, and then it's more helpful. And sometimes it's mixed, and we'll get to actually experience ourselves kind of maybe going back and forth, you know? So maybe we start out as with a kind of wholesome desire or wholesome craving to become more generous, or to deepen our understanding, yeah, or to be healthier, you know. So all those are healthy and wholesome, right? And so that can lead to a motivation to undertake certain actions and to do certain things, you know. It can lead to certain behaviors. You know, maybe we pay more attention to how we're eating, or maybe we volunteer or do, you know, certain activities that are wholesome and helpful. It's the longing, I think of it more to kind of create, it's like we have an image of ourselves in our mind that we're somehow trying to get to, yeah? And we're trying to promote that or make sure that that's seen, make sure that that's validated. So it's more like protecting an image and an idea of ourselves. As, you know, we may have a very generous impulse or, you know, a craving to become more generous, but we also want to be seen and recognized for it. So that's where it kind of starts to tip into wanting to think of myself, wanting to be known as, wanting to have an image of myself as a generous person, right? Yeah. So rather than staying like almost just like very granularly with the impulse itself, right? So that's hopefully a short version, but there are, we talked about this at Under 40 as well. There are wholesome forms of desire, of craving. Yeah. So, but we have to feel it out for ourselves. Where does this lead? So we can ask, you know, maybe it starts out wholesome, but then it becomes an identity project. You know, I need to tell everyone how generous I am, or I start fantasizing about how everyone is going to love me and appreciate me now that I'm, you know, this kind of person. So a lot of it, it comes with a lot of mental churning. Yeah. Whereas if it's a wholesome impulse and we can kind of stay with it and follow it, it doesn't actually need a lot of promoting, defending, doesn't need a lot of thought. It kind of leads in a helpful direction that we can feel simple and useful and kind of healthy. Doesn't need a lot. So that gives you a feel for it. Yeah, Austin, do you have something?
Just be quick because it already was came up here. But the lie that I was telling myself is that craving is necessary to succeed for high performance.
Mm.
And then I asked myself, wait, is that true?
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, it's not true. And then it kind of emerged for me that you actually said the word that, at least for me, there's a difference between craving and longing. And there's a longing of the heart for safety, for dignity, for belonging. But the mind will trick me into thinking that this craving for some short-term goal is going to satisfy the deeper longing that's there for safety, for dignity, and belonging. When the settling begins to come in, then the short heart's release reveals the deeper longing that's there.
Mm.
So I think language can be helpful and narrative can be helpful in some ways to give us new ways of describing our experience and noting those differences. Like for me, it's coming up, you know, craving and longing are coming up as two things to play with in my experience.
Great. I love the way you practiced with that. Turning it into a question is so helpful. So helpful. It's really helpful for me. Yeah. And you also pointed to something that's really important in this territory, which is like short term and long term. So that's another area of exploration, you know, often thing, you know, think the candy emporium. It's a crude example, but often things that are more craving-based will have a short-term payoff, but won't lead us, but won't be onward leading. They'll just lead to wanting more. So, you know, the likes and the all of that, the ups and downs with the likes and the people not recognizing us in a certain way will have a short-term, but it won't lead to a long-term helpful direction, which has a very different feel. So connectedness. Connectedness, yes, yes. Not a quick hit.
The likes is not the same as the
day. No, like Esther Perel says, some the wonderful therapist. She says you can have 10,000 likes on social media, but no one to feed your cat. Yeah, which is wonderful. So a very different feel. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So I think Alan online, hand up. Hi, Alan. Good to see you.
Hi, Jerry. It's good to see you. Thanks. Thanks for the talk. I've heard this topic quite a few times, but tonight I think I connected in some new way. And I wanted to share something, and you know, you can give me your thought on it, but lately I've had times I felt kind of unsettled or unsafe. And my mind, you know, starts to go to like, oh, I should do some meta to resolve this, or oh, I should go have a conversation with somebody, or I should, you know, go throw on a lighthearted comedy, which I think are all, you know, in certain contexts, good things to do, but on at least one occasion, I've just stopped and I've been like, well, you know, what is this? Like, what, like, can I just see how close I can get to this? You know, can I just like be, you know, curious about this? Can I, you know, and try not to just, I find, you know, I went through a period of practice where I found, like, when I was afraid, I could just call it fear. And it felt like it was getting me out of the fear. But even that wasn't, there's still some mental distancing going on. And now when this unsettling is coming, it's just like a nonverbal, like how close can I, you know, contact this?
That's a beautiful question that you just ended with. Yeah.
And I'd like to wrap it up in a ribbon and say, you know, it just went away and I don't have these feelings. You know, that's not it, but it's...
Yeah. I think we underestimate the power of, you know, we kind of, and this tendency has been there for me too at times, we expect that if we're practicing well, things are just going to evaporate in a puff of smoke, you know? But remember, like the snake, this is a long process of unconditioning deep patterns. It doesn't mean we're never going to be afraid again. So, you know, we can notice that every time fear comes up, along with it can be a sense of disappointment or, you know, discouragement or confusion, like, oh, why is this coming? I shouldn't be experiencing this. Or, you know, it can lead to a whole chain of events. But if we're just there, just with that arising, like how close can I get to this? Or like Rodney would always say, is there love for this too? Or can I feel this? Is there space to feel this? If you don't make an assumption, is there space to feel this? Just feel this as a human experience, fear, uncertainty. Yeah. And not with any expectation that it go away, that you practice it away or zap it away. But if our intent is always like learning how the mind operates, what helps us unhook, what gets us more caught, then everything can be an experience, a worthwhile experience. You know, when we get hopelessly caught, when we unhook, all of that. But the unhooking, I think in some ways of talking about it, it makes it feel like there's somehow more active. But letting go in a lot of ways is letting it be. And I said that once in a class and someone started singing, let it be, in the middle of the class. So anyway, it's sometimes, a lot of times less is more. So just letting that movement of fear happen without picking it up, without feeding it, without fighting it. Just a movement of fear. Sometimes even without techniquing it at all. Yeah. But I loved your question, you know, how can I, it's a very sincere question. How close can I get to this? Yeah.
Thanks for sharing, Carrie.
Good to see you. Excellent. Right, everyone. I want to be respectful of our time tonight. So as we move towards closing, I hope you can appreciate some.